Welcome back to the Time by the Tent podcast. Thank you for being with us and downloading the program today. I'm Joy Baird.
I'm Holly Baird.
And we are going to go to the hotline to bring in our guest this week. He is a YouTuber out of Minnesota. Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for the week.
Terry is the creator of YouTube channel Trey Runs Wild. He shows his off-grid tiny cabin located in the wilds of northern Minnesota. He shows activities, projects that promote self-sufficiency, and a weekend homesteading theme. Welcome to the program, Terry.
Well, thank you for having me. It's good to hear from you guys again.
Well, we are happy that you've taken time out to talk with us. And we'll start with this. For people who may be looking to purchase land, what are two things to avoid and two things to absolutely do?
Well, let's start in order with the things to avoid. And going back to my kind of my life history story, I have always wanted land of my own. Ever since I was a kid, I had this dream about being self-sufficient and going out in the woods and living off the land and, you know, making a garden and being self-reliant. And, you know, life comes along and I either never had the time or I never had the money. And then you become a father and a husband and your priorities change. So later in life, my son and I, we were looking for hunting property, and it just dawned on me that the only way we're ever going to find a place to deer hunt is if we somehow get land ourselves. And so I went back onto the journey of trying to find that piece of property that I always wanted and living out a little bit of that dream that I had, because for once in my life, I had both the time and the resources to be able to do it. But one of the things that has held me back and held me back over the years was I don't have any construction skills and I don't know what I'm doing. But the one thing that I learned was that my fear of failure was preventing me from making the step years before I finally did. And in this day and age, there's so many resources out there, be it YouTube or just online internet searches or communities of like-minded people that are willing to put their journeys on Facebook or other social media outlets. So the biggest thing that I think is the thing to avoid is don't do it because you're afraid to make the step. If you're afraid that it's going to be a financial thing and maybe you'll change your mind later, my belief is that land is generally always a wise investment if you get decent quality land, especially in times of per se economic downturn. They always talk about getting hard assets. If the dollar is weak, you know, invest in something that's going to retain its value and not be so dependent. And land is one of those things where everybody wants some and they're not making any more of it. It's really not going to go down in price generally. So the biggest number one thing I think to avoid when you start thinking about doing these things or getting a piece of property is don't let your fear of the unknown stop you. There's just too many resources out there to guide you on your way. And if you change your mind later, you can always sell it, probably for a profit. So that would be probably my biggest thing. You know, second of all, when I bought my property, I did a lot of internet searching. And my property is, you know, a few hours away from where my regular house is. And it wasn't easy just to drive up there and take a look at all these different properties. So I really was dependent on the real estate listing and the photos that went along with it. And when I purchased my property, there were other people that were looking at it at the time, and this was in February. So I was a little bit under the gun as far as making a decision. And when I bought my property, the only time that I had walked it was in the winter. And I was able to find out, like, where low areas were, just because I was able to look at like county GIS wetland maps and things like that, where I had geological documents that showed what the topography was and the resources and stuff on the land. But the one thing that I wasn't aware of is the way that water would pool when frost is in the ground. And I ended up having some seasonably wet or some intermittent wet areas that I never expected to be wet because they were high ground, but because of the way the frost or the bedrock was in the ground, I would have never expected to have low areas or wet areas in the spring that I ended up having. So my biggest thing is make sure that you get out there and you look at this in as many different opportunities as you can to see as the seasons change. And I understand that, you know, a lot of times you're under the gun and these listings that are good, they go fast and you need to make a decision. But the other things to consider is, you know, how are the bugs in the summertime? You know, if you buy it in the fall, how are the bugs in the summer? Is it absolutely unbearable with mosquitoes and black flies and gnats and different things like that? Is that going to be something that doesn't affect the value of the land, but it may affect your enjoyment of the land? And so my second thing would just be to try to get some time walking the land and do a little bit of research with neighbors or in the area, look at, you know, different resources that would give you an idea of, like, is there bridges that have been built in certain areas, or have they brought in gravel in certain areas to make, you know, different roads? Because those things could be indicators too, or culverts, things like that, that maybe there's going to be some intermittent water there, either during a rainy season or during spring breakup. So that those would probably be the two things that I would avoid, is A, letting fear stop you, and B, buying a piece of property sight unseen, just based on, you know, internet photos or what the realtor is telling you. So, but, you know, when I started talking about things that you have to do, I'll just kind of touch on something that was came as a little bit of a shock to me. And I'll get into this a little bit more later, but it's really important to check with the county where your property is located. If it's located within a municipal boundary, then check with the city. And then, of course, your state may have separate boundaries as well. And then there could even be, like, federal land that your land may be encompassed by. My particular piece of private property is surrounded by a half private land and then half federal national forest. And so there are certain things that I can and can't do based upon the jurisdictional governments that surround my area, which I kind of expected there to be some sort of zoning, but my area, it's so rural that it's unincorporated and there isn't even a township. So generally within a county, you have individual townships, which are run by a county or a township board. And they take care of, like, you know, the gravel roads and snow plowing and things like that. But my area is so rural, and because it's partly federal, I don't have a township. So generally some of the zoning things that would apply to some people did not apply to me. But I did find out that the county had some rules that required some permits and some regulations that I wasn't aware of at the time. Recently, I went in to get a permit to build a sauna and a bathhouse, and I was denied my permit because they would have required some sort of gray water retention or septic or something like that, where my intent was to merely run it out. You know, you take a shower and you let the gray water run out onto the ground, which apparently you're not allowed to do. So the big thing is check your areas, your counties and townships and your state for zoning laws. And they would generally be under, like, your building permits or county zoning. That's where you would typically look. The second thing that's pretty important, if you do decide to build some sort of structure that's more than just temporary, and at some point you want to have a reliable water source there. Right now, my cabin is a dry cabin, which means I have no access to water on the property. But some people may find that a well is extremely important to them. And that would be one of the things that I would also recommend that you really must do if a well is important, is check with, like, your county extension agent, or even maybe, like, your local well drillers, or if there's none in the area, even, like, call up a neighbor if you can find them on, like, a plat map. Because one thing I found, and I do plan to put in a Sandpoint shallow well this summer, but the way my bedrock lies, it may be fairly difficult to be able to get to water, even though I have a lot of, like, surface water. And depending on your area, you may not have water, you know, you may not be able to put a shallow Sandpoint in. You may have to have an actual pump well, which would require electricity, and you may have to go down 200, 300, 400, 500 feet to get good water. So if the well is important and you're willing to, if you want more than hauling water in, check about the resources of water availability in your area, because geologically it could be a lot different than what you expect. And you know, that could be a real bummer later if you found out that you couldn't punch a well and get fresh water. So.
Right. And your zoning permits, even though people who are listening may not be on YouTube or broadcasting what they're doing, there are still people that have the legal access to come on your property to see if you're doing things legally.
Yes, and I think that kind of maybe depends on which state you're in and in which county. But typically, you know, the county in which you pay taxes generally has some sort of right to place an assessed value on your property, and how they do that accurately is by viewing, you know, the structures or your property. And each state could be different about how far they can come into the curtilage. You know, some states may say they have to come from the road. Other states may say they can walk around the perimeter of the property. So each one would be different. But yes, that's absolutely true. You know, the other thing that I would do, and Joey, you and I and Holly have talked about this a little bit before, one of the pieces of property that I considered buying, there was an easement or access to that 40 acres through the edge of somebody else's property. And the property was a pretty good price, and I was going to go out and look at it. And then I found out that the adjacent property owner had this armed standoff with law enforcement because he had threatened the previous landowner for using that access avenue adjacent to his land, even though lawfully the landowner had access to it. The adjacent landowner was so difficult to deal with that there's just no way I would have ever purchased that property after he had brought a gun and threatened to kill the guy who was accessing, you know, his own property. So one of the other things that I would do is check with your local law enforcement, even do a data privacy request for public data. So if you have like the address of your piece of land or your piece of property, you can typically go into like your local sheriff and say, hey, I'd like to do a public data request on this address. Can you provide me any information of police response to this area? And that may help you with like, hey, did they investigate a meth lab on this place 10 years ago? And maybe I need to worry about some chemicals or garbage left behind, or maybe, you know, the neighbors next door are really difficult to deal with and there's been a lot of law enforcement interaction. Those are kind of some quiet under the radar things that you can find yourself getting involved in when you buy a property if you haven't done like your due diligence on finding out who your neighbors are. So that's the other thing that I would definitely recommend is do a little bit of searching about who's living around the property that you're looking at buying, and are they decent people, or do you need to be, you know, second guessing that you'd want to be their neighbor.
So you got an Amish built shed. So it's just a shed, a pretty basic shed, that you were converting into a cabin. Why did you go with that versus something like a wall tent, like a canvas wall tent where you maybe built like a platform or something?
Sure. Well, when I first bought my property, I was originally just camping in my van. And in my van, I kind of rigged up to be kind of a camping place. And I had always wanted to build a cabin. And for a couple of reasons. One was just for the longer term structure of it. And second of all, to just have something that was tighter structurally. Like mice and rodents can be a real problem. And I wanted to be able to have like a couch or a mattress available and not have to worry about them being destroyed every time I came up because the rodents got into them. And I had had a canvas teepee way back when I was younger that I used for just camping on my yard property. And what I found over years was like the birds would sit on the poles and they would defecate on the canvas, and the acid and the feces after 10 years kind of ate away at some of the canvas. And there's some things you can do different to prevent that. But I just wanted something that was structurally more permanent. And because I have no skills, of course, building an actual cabin, I had looked into plans and whatnot, and I was willing to take that on. But I would drive to my property by this Amish sawmill every time on my way. And one day they had a shed out there, and it kind of looked like a cabin, even though it's just a shed. It was a little bit more than like a, you know, a Home Depot shed. And I stopped in and I talked to the guy, and never thinking that they would deliver one way out to my place, because this was probably another 175 miles from where I bought the shed. And I talked to the guy and he's like, yep, we can build you this shed that you want for $3,600, like $3,650 to be exact, and we'll deliver it to you for $850. And I thought, my gosh, I cannot buy the lumber to build a small cabin for that. And plus, instead of it taking me 2 years to build the cabin, you know, because I come up there on the weekends, it can just be delivered and I can have an immediate shelter right off the bat.
And not counting the frustration.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you've watched my YouTube videos, you know, I do a lot of things wrong because it's a learning process. And just, you know, the waste of materials and the extra expense and really having to research every move, it just made sense financially and logistically for my purposes.
Absolutely, yeah. If it can be done and done right and saves you a whole lot of headache, sometimes it's okay to pay a little bit more money on the front end to make it happen quicker. As we get older, we don't have that time of, I'll make it happen in 10 years. 10 years is not 10 years as it was 20 years ago.
And sometimes something like bugs and pests and et cetera, people don't always think about. They might they think, you know, they live in a home that is fine. There's probably not a lot of bugs. But when you're exposing yourself to the great outdoors, it's not something you always think about.
Absolutely. And the nice thing about saving the money by having them do the work for me is I was able to take that money then that I saved and use it towards finishing the inside, so it was more of a cabin than actually just a shed. Or at least it feels that way, you know.
Oh, it looks beautiful on the inside compared to what it was. And you've probably doubled or tripled the value of that easily by completing it. Now, I'm going to guess you'll never sell it, but knowing what you've got in there, it's well worth the enjoyment.
Right. Yes, for sure. And it does feel, when you have something that's comfortable, you want to spend more time there,
right.
You know, and it's fun to think about being so rustic, but for me personally, like, if I'm going to have guests or my kids or, you know, my spouse come up, they want a little bit more creature comforts than you know, living under a bush lean-to, you know?
Right, so, right. Well, yeah. you live in the cabin or the property is in northern Minnesota, and for people who know about outdoors animals, that's black bear country. Do you see a lot of black bears? Do you have to encounter them? How do you deal with that type of animal on your property?
Sure. Yeah, I definitely have a high density of black bears in my area. In fact, I talked to the local DNR biologist, and one of the gravel roads that is across the tar road from my access, they actually call the Bear Highway because there's such a high density of bears on that particular road. And I have had them on my game camera in camp, and I have seen them on my property in person, but I've never seen one in person in my camp. So I think when I'm on the property, between me making noise and the dog, I think they just stay away. You know, there's thousands of acres of wildland around my property, so there's plenty of room for them to roam. The other thing that they did was the private land that sits adjacent to the back half of my property, they came in and selectively logged that about 5 years ago, and most of it was mature forest otherwise, but that really created a lot of new growth, which, when you open up old forest, you get a lot more berries, you get a lot more sucky, you know, tender green grasses and things like that. And the bears have plenty of, or much more variable and plentiful food sources, so they don't have as much need to come into my camp to look for bird seed or things like that. The only thing I'm concerned about is my barbecue grill. You know, if I'm out grilling hamburgers and you get the grease in the grill and then I leave for a couple days, I'm really surprised that I've not come back yet and had my grill just torn to pieces because, you know, they can smell the grease in it. But so far, so good. I got my fingers crossed.
It may be one of them things that they know there's habitat there, like humans. And apparently, from what I understand, they're kind of like coyotes or other wildlife. They're more scared of you and what you're doing or your property than you are of them.
Yes. And black bears, I'm really not afraid of them. You know, I've come across them in the woods, you know, a fair number of times. The only time I would really be concerned is in the spring when they have cubs.
Yeah.
Definitely do not want to get between a mother and her cubs, but they're so unlike grizzlies. Like grizzlies, I've done some hiking out west, and they absolutely terrify me. Just a completely night and day difference between the different types of bears.
All right, great. So you speak about your wife and your kids, and I know in some of your videos you go hunting with your son, Hunter, and then we've seen some videos of your wife visiting the
and your daughter on
your daughter too. Now they don't show up on the videos a lot. I'm assuming they enjoy the land, but do they just not want to be on YouTube? I know sometimes when people have a spouse or a parent, they think about the impact of the internet and they don't want to show up on the videos, or is this something they're just not used to?
Sure. No, well, so the reality is they don't really come up very often. Like, this is my thing. This is for me. And part of it was, you know, making that place where my son and I could have this hunting place, and I could put in gardens and fruit trees and, you know, do my thing there. Yes, my spouse does come up a couple times a year. It's not a place that she doesn't have the same feelings towards it that I do. And she is more happy being in the house, you know, in closer to town and doing her things there. My daughter, and so her and my daughter want nothing to do with YouTube.
Okay.
They're like, don't film us. We don't want to be in the public eye. We don't want to be part of your dorky videos, you know. And but my son, on the other hand, he's gotten used to it over the years, and he just doesn't care. So he's pretty okay with it. So the few times that they do come up, because both my kids are in college now, they're out of the house, and so the times when they're all up, I'm just respectful about their wishes and their privacy. So,
well, my grandparents are 85, and before they had a cell phone, they were on the internet and they didn't know it. So if you're alive, you're on the internet, whether you want to be or not, in some form or fashion. That's how scary the system is.
And a lot of things, if you have a landline, or if you ever had a landline,
yeah,
that you can still look that up and you can find somebody's address, and it's not hard to find a lot of information quickly, unfortunately. But yeah, it makes sense. I know a lot of people just don't want their face essentially on some place. Yeah.
So of the things that you've done on your property over the last 4 years, what is something dangerous you have done that you probably shouldn't have, and you learned a lesson about it and you're not going to take that risk again?
Well, you know, one of the things about living out, or not living, but one of the things about spending time out in rural areas is, for me personally, the closest hospital is 30 miles away. And so I try to be fairly conscious about safety and risk versus reward. But sometimes there are things that you just have to do because they just need to be done and there's no way around it. So I really don't do a lot of dangerous things, but one of the things that I do that probably could get me hurt is felling trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some widow makers on the property where the top has broken off and it's still hanging there. And I've had some trees that I thought were more solid, and I start sawing into them and they're completely hollow through the middle. And, you know, I'm waiting for 80 feet above me to come crashing down at me at any point. So really, I think probably the only thing that I could really consider dangerous is the felling of some trees on my property. And I know there's one that in particular that made me very nervous. And what I did was I actually called my daughter before I started cutting the tree. And I just said, "Hey, I'm cutting this tree. It's a little bit sketchy. If I don't call you back in 20 minutes, call the local sheriff and have them do a welfare check on me." And as it turns out, you know, the tree went fine. But you do have to think about, like, even small things. You know, if I'm using my axe and I split my foot open, or, you know, if I do, you know, have an accident with the chainsaw, help is a long way from my place. And if I'm not able to drive into town myself, that means I have to wait a half hour for an ambulance to get to me, and then a half hour for them to get me to the hospital. So you do have to be cognizant about, like, even first aid things, like, you know, having, you know, things like fire extinguishers and first aid kits, and making sure your cell phone's with you if you can get cell service. So you do need, in fact, it's funny because one of my viewers had actually commented to me, and he's like, you know, here's a tip for you. You always, a lot of times you put the nose of your car facing in toward your driveway and the back end facing out towards your access. And he says, why don't, when you get there, you turn your vehicle around? So if you ever need to make a hasty exit, the last thing you need to worry about is backing up quickly, you know, or backing off the road into the mud or something like that. So just little things are probably things that you need to think about that you'd never think about in town, or if you were, you know, 3 miles out of town.
And you had an incident with a chainsaw. Now, was that on the property, or was that?
No, that actually wasn't even on my property.
Okay.
That a friend from work had a big tree that dropped in his yard, and part of the tree dropped on his neighbor's cars. So, of course, I do a fair amount of sawing up at the land, and I'm like, yeah, absolutely, I'll come over, help you buck this tree up and get it off the neighbor's car. And the very first cut with the chainsaw, what I failed to realize was that limb resting on the car was under so much tension. And this was a very large old maple tree. And there was just so much tension on that limb that when I started cutting through it and it lost the integrity, it just exploded. And that limb came back and actually hit me in the face and split my chin open fairly decent. I ended up having a bunch of stitches and, to be honest, I'm surprised I didn't lose some teeth, but luckily it hit me at just the right angle where if it would have hit me more from the side, I probably would have lost some teeth, no doubt. But yeah, you know, sawing is definitely not something to take lightly, for sure. You always got to be on your toes.
Right. And you use quality equipment too. It's not just El Cheapo you bought on sale. You use steel, and that's what we would get when we have land. That's what my family has used on the farm. I think it's the best there is. And if you're going to do stuff like that, you need to have quality equipment so you can rely on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love steel. I have a couple different. I have two different saws: a smaller one and then a larger one. They start every mm-hmm. single time, even if I don't use them for over the winter for 2 months. You know, they've just been super reliable. And of course, I don't wear them all the time, but you should have a good set of chaps and some steel-toed boots. And, of course, hearing protection and eye protection, absolutely. And really, I don't have this, but a lot of people will even wear, you know, a logger's helmet, because a lot of times when you start putting vibration on that tree, if it's dead, there can be some dead limbs way up ahead that'll break loose. And if they fall down on your head when you're focusing on the saw bar, you know, you're not going to get knocked out and hopefully, you know, traumatic brain injury.
Right.
Because you didn't have protection. So.
And people say steel is expensive. You get what you pay for when you buy a steel chainsaw. And that's quality.
Yeah, I believe that 100%. I've had some cheaper saws in the past, and they tend to be disposable saws mm-hmm. after about 3 years. So,
well, we really have enjoyed having you on the program. How can people find out more about you and your great YouTube channel?
Yeah, so I'm not on a lot of social media. I do have a small Instagram account, but I really don't use that very often. My main platform is YouTube, and my channel is Trey Runs Wild, which is T-R-E, which is merely my initials, which is my first name, middle name, and last name, first initials. And so if you look for Trey Runs Wild, you'll be able to find my channel and come along for the fun.
Well, Terry, we greatly appreciate the time you've offered and the insight and education that you've shared with people who may not be aware of things because they just don't know about it. And we thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'm excited to follow you guys along on your journey, and I'm looking forward to your new channel coming up as well.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, we're sure happy that Terry took time out of his day to join us on the program. A lot of good information he provided for us.
Yeah, definitely, especially for people like are looking for land to purchase. Very good information, and if possibly in bear country.
Right. So thank you for tuning into the program. Thank you for downloading the show, and tune in next time for the program for more hiking, camping, land management, and everything in between. For
Holly Baird,
I'm Joy Baird, and we will see you in the woods.